Hello, Bill.
Welcome back.
Welcome back. Welcome back, Lewis.
The DMZ has missed your presence.
Well, it's good to be back. It's good to be back. I didn't watch all the shows when I was gone. I saw somebody literally holding up a telephone to their ear, and I knew it was time that I come back when I saw that.
Well, a lot has happened since you were gone. Aussie Rules Football started a new season. My North Melbourne Kangaroos are 2-1, so that's very exciting.
Nice.
And I have not gotten a haircut since you were gone, so I look worse than ever. I'm trying to think what else of importance has transpired. That's the big stuff. Maple season's over. This is not quite over. It's the last weekend for the Sugar Shacks. You only got a few days left.
I am worried that the frost line may be moving, which could impinge upon Sugar Shack season.
Well, I think we are. It is now warm enough in New England that the sap is actually running anymore, I think, because we're not having freezing nights. But the Sugar Shack's got one more weekend left to get your fresh syrup, get your fresh pancakes this weekend. My plug is always for Steve Sugar Shack in West Hampton, Massachusetts. So that's what's going on over here. What's going on down in Southern DMZ?
The blossoms, cherry blossom season,
right?
So it's beautiful. I just had breakfast down.
You know what we have to thank for our cherry blossoms?
The communist Chinese, right?
Well, why those Japanese?
Is it the Japanese? Okay, well,
and Helen Taft. That's
who?
Helen Taft's legacy.
Taft,
William Howard Taft's wife.
Okay, so that was like a beautification project or something?
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I think some little diplomacy with Japan, too.
Thank you, Helen Taft. They're beautiful. I just had breakfast at Old Ebbitt Grill and walked through Lafayette Park, I guess it is. And they don't last long enough, but they're very nice. They're very pretty. And so hopefully spring is finally here, sort of. So I'm happy about that. And the baseball season, the Orioles have been doing pretty well. They've taken a couple from the Yankees this week, so we can't complain.
I don't know how baseball's doing. How are the Nationals doing?
I'm not following the Nationals that closely.
You're an Orioles man.
Well, nominally I'm a fan of the Nets for my National League team. And they look really strong this year. I think the Nats, I think Sports Illustrated, actually, this is probably a curse, but Sports Illustrated predicted that they would win the World Series this year. So they got a good team, and I think the NL East isn't nearly as strong as the AL East. That's the problem for the Orioles. And I'm a Marylander at heart, and the team that I find myself watching is more often than not the Orioles instead of the Nats. But they're in a tougher division. They got the Red Sox and the Yankees are perpetually, I want to say nipping at their heels, but it's usually the other way around. So the AL East is a tough division. I should probably just start watching the Nats more and bring my son up as a Nats fan, my sons, because.
Yeah, I was just reading, we weren't planning to talk about this to such great length, but I was just reading an article about how the demographics of the baseball audience are increasingly skewing old, that almost no young people are watching baseball today. I was sort of thinking to myself, what's the right year to bring, my daughter to a baseball game? When would she actually sit through it and actually enjoy it?
I'm thinking, 10 years old.
Maybe the answer is never. Maybe it's never. Kids just don't like baseball. The sport's going to die, or it's going to be like hockey where it kind of limps along and only the diehards really follow it.
Well, the problem is, there's a great – have you seen, Bill, there's a great George Carlin skit about the difference between football and baseball?
Right, yeah.
Football is played in the winter when everything dies, that whole thing. And then in football, you get a penalty. In baseball, you make an error. Whoops. But the thing that Carlin really highlights is that football is a 21st century game, and there's a clock, and there's strategy, and baseball is an American, you know, sort of pastoral pastime. And therein lies the problem. It's a pastime from a bygone era. I love it. It's funny that kids don't like it because I liked it more as a kid when I had the time to invest in 162 games a year. I feel like as an adult, football, it's a commitment of one time a week. You just watch that one game. 3 hours if you're a Redskins fan of misery, and that's it. And, you know, so... And it also, in my life, you know, I'm used to trying to get things done, right? Beat the clock, manage the score. And so football feels more like what I do in my life, in a weird way, strategically speaking, as opposed to a baseball game, which is, again, a pastime.
But have you actually brought your kids to a baseball game yet?
Oh no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't do it until they're about 10 years old, Bill.
Okay.
There's no way that a toddler is going to sit through 9 innings. It would be a trail of tears. One of my friends, and people think that they're being nice, and God bless them. I know they're trying when they invite me to do stuff. one of my friends invited me to go see a Redskins game at FedEx Field and bring my son, my older son, who's 3. That's a nightmare. That is a nightmare. Like, getting to FedEx Field is you got to pack a lunch just for that trek.
Right, right.
And parking, I would spend half my time taking him to the potty, we're not going to sit there and enjoy the game. Much more fun to watch it. And God love them. I really appreciate the intent, but not till they're about 10 years old will I be taking.
But your oldest will watch it on TV?
Oh, you know, for a few minutes. And he calls it hockey ball. No matter what, I can't convince him that there's no such thing as that there isn't hockey ball. But, Bill, here's the other problem I have. The in-laws. I'm an only child, but my wife has 3 brothers, and her dad is still alive. And they are Yankees. They're hockey fans. They root for the New York Rangers or something. And they root for the New York Yankees. And, so I'm, like, fighting off my kids becoming like seduced into the charmed life of being a Yankees fan.
I didn't know that you were married to a New Yorker.
She's not a New Yorker. That's the weirdest part. They're just, I guess, people who like winners, apparently. they're just capitalists.
I know you would respect that.
No. For me, baseball and conservatism is all about lost causes. And so anyway, it's romantic. It's more romantic that way. I'm a romantic at heart,
Well, one conservative project where I think you might be on the winning side on is this company Uber. I don't fully understand this whole thing, but I saw recently, even when you were gone, lads, I wistfully look at your Twitter feed to see what you're up to, and I saw you did a tour of the Uber headquarters with Senator Rubio. It seems like conservatives are sort of embracing this company as the example of libertarian innovation, I guess.
Yeah.
And I don't totally get why this company as opposed to other companies, so maybe you can explain that to me.
Right. Well, first, let me I was talking about what they do. I could hold up my iPhone, but I don't know if it would work on the dual split screen here. But so basically, what Uber is it's a car service. They have different levels of cars. You can get like a limo sort of black town car, or you can get just a regular a professional driver who's driving. Just a regular car, like a new Toyota or something. Or you can get a cab via Uber. And so basically what happens is you're on your iPhone, you get on the app, and it uses GPS. It knows where you are. So you just click a button, and it will send a cab to my office to pick me up. Or I never do the cabs. I usually use, I think it's called Uber X or something, but I use like the regular car. So it's a lower rate than if you got a limo. But it's a professional, you know, it's a professional clean, you know, car, and it comes, it knows where you are by GPS. And then it charges you a rate that frankly is about what you would pay, maybe slightly higher than what you would pay with a cab, but much better service. And you don't have to tip. The tip is built in, and you don't need to have any cash. It automatically charges your card. You can watch. It'll say, like, when I call an Uber car, it'll say, like, you know, he is 5 minutes or 5 miles away, and you can, like, literally watch where his car is heading toward you on a map. A map that's on the iPhone or on your smartphone, part of the Uber app. And so then the beauty here, at the end, you rate them and they rate you. So you give the driver a possible 5 stars, you know, rating or something, and it's 4 or 5 stars, and they rate you. And so it's based on reputation. And, you know, the other beauty is, it's not, you know, like, sometimes I've gotten into cabs and you're like, is this person going to kill me? You know, is this person going to drive me into the middle of nowhere and kill me? Here, everybody knows where you are. The company knows where you are. You know, you're being tracked on GPS. You know who the driver is. You know, they've had previous ratings. It's like if you buy something on Amazon that has a 99%, you know, approval rating or whatever it is, a customer rating. So you know them, they know you, you're not carrying cash. It's a clean, safe car, and it's just a really cool idea. And the reason that it became political is that the incumbent cab companies and cab commissions in places like Washington, D.C. did not want this service to happen. They were trying to stifle this innovation and protect the cab companies. And so they've tried to pass laws that would make it illegal for Uber to operate. It's just a better service than cab companies. It's very convenient. I mean, I've had other situations too where, like, I've gone to events that are not, you know, they're in areas where cabs don't frequent, you know, so you can't just, I would go to a dinner somewhere, but it's at a place, it's not a hotel, so you can't, like, step out and hail a cab. And you really can't call a cab and expect, call a cab company and expect them to come, but you can Uber, and they will come get you. And so it's just a really cool service, and Marco Rubio, I think, sort of wisely tapped into the idea that that young progressives who, you know, or millennials who use this service have no idea that this is kind of a conservative idea, that, you know, that innovation is good and that regulations to keep them out are bad.
Well, I'm curious. Okay, I'm not in D.C., so I don't know exactly, you know, to what extent is this really Uber versus cab companies, or whether, or is it more liberal versus conservatism on the ground in D.C.? I did see this piece today by Matt Stoller, who is someone who I generally disagree with. He's a different stripe of liberal than I am. If he even calls himself liberal, I'm not sure if he does.
Is he the guy who like went to work for like Alan Grayson?
Yeah, he was a big player in early blogosphere, and he then shifted to be on Grayson's team, and I think was kind of a bit of a brainchild as far as how to market Grayson via YouTube and have him, you know, have. Dramatic, bombastic hearing appearances that would go viral on YouTube. And I don't think he works with him now. I could be mistaken. I mean, he's another project since he was working with Russell Brand's talk show for a time, for example. And I know he's worked with the Roosevelt Institute, but I'm not exactly sure where his perch is right now, but I know he's doing some freelance writing. And so he wrote a big piece that was posted on Naked Capitalism, arguing that Uber is aiming for a monopoly. So it's not really a question of having free competition, that they're trying to rig the game. And he writes, Uber is aiming for an algorithmic monopoly, control of a market through contract pricing. That the contract pricing is done with a complicated algorithm, there's this whole computer model involved with how they set prices, doesn't make it a market, it just makes it complicated. Standard Oil would love this rationale. So he goes on to say, Uber controls all the information in the so-called market. One of the premises of a market is relatively balanced information on the part of both the buyer and the seller, but Uber is neither a buyer or a seller, it's a broker, and as a broker, it shows the buyer and seller only what it wants to. Its algorithm is not regulated, nor is it transparent, so neither the buyer or the seller has any credible information. This isn't a market, it's a monopoly. It's a special type of monopoly. It may mimic market-style pricing or may not, that's up to Uber. And then he goes on to say, we've already seen Uber withhold supply to drive up prices. It's illustrated by a text message encouraging drivers to stay home so pricing would surge. Uber denies doing this, but even the denial proves the point that Uber absolutely controls all aspects of the market. Now, I look at that and I say to myself, that seems a little paranoid, even if it's what Uber wants to do. It certainly is in the power of city government or state government or national government to have regulations to contain it, and or at minimum, there's nothing in there that suggests some other company can't do what Uber's doing and compete with Uber. There's nothing to suggest that they're going to get special treatment or need special treatment to own the entire market. But it may mean that if there are examples where they're not being transparent and they're getting an unfair advantage because some regulations around that, but you don't have to have regulations that bar them from entry and have a essentially protectionist rule to protect existing companies and screw over new companies. It just seems like there's lots of opportunity for middle ground here. And I would assume just sort of naturally middle ground would emerge. So I have a hard time seeing this as like the flashpoint for an ultimate battle between regulation and freedom.
Well, a couple of things, Bill. First, I'm on Uber's side against the cab companies. I think this is a product. I think this is an example of creative destruction. I think that cab companies are antiquated. I think that they will go out like the horse and buggy. And I think any attempt to prop them up and keep them alive is really fighting history, essentially. So I'm with Uber on that. Now, here's the problem. Uber has attempted to do shady things themselves. For example, they've tried to, in some cities, once they were able to gain entry, they've tried to bar other competitors from entering by helping, you know, lobby to craft laws in such a way that they would comply and their competitors wouldn't. In some cases, maybe there's a legitimate reason for this, right? So it's one thing to have professional limo drivers sort of doing this. It's another thing for me to just say, oh, well, I'm going to, without any sort of certification or regulation, I'm just going to flip on my switch today and start charging people to ride with me. Well, nobody's vetted me. Nobody's checked me out. So rather than being a safer alternative for consumers, that could be a more dangerous alternative. So look, I think what we need is competition. There's another instance where Uber essentially was screwing with one of their competitors. They would actually order a car from one of their competitors and then cancel it so that their competitors' drivers were like, you know, riding around, sort of wasting their time. That's not cool. And they're sort of, you know, what I want is competition. I would love to have two or three or four companies in cities like Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and Boston or whatever, who do what Uber does. That's the real solution. So I think that while conservatives are onto something and rooting for Uber as a really cool technology that's dramatically better than the cab companies. I think it would be a mistake to sort of jump on the Uber bandwagon because, like, this is what businesses do. They try to have monopolies. And so, you know, that wouldn't be any better either. The one thing I will say about
this, and we have antitrust law. You know, we have a longstanding system that largely prevents monopolies.
Except that in a lot of cities, the cab companies do have a state-based monopoly, and so they don't give you good service. I mean, if you lose your wallet in a cab. In a New York cab or in a DC cab, you will never get it back. You know, the odds are very good you'll never get it back. Like, even if the cabbie was honest, how would you contact them? How would you even know what cab number you were in? If you left your wallet in an Uber car, you would have no trouble tracking it down. I think that cab companies do have monopolies, state-run monopolies, and that's one of the reasons that I like Uber.
I mean, but to be fair, in cities, you don't have a single cab company gets a free ride. You have, I think it's a more complicated structure.
Well, you have to get medallions. There's like a limited number of medallions, and you have to buy the medallions and all that bullshit.
Right, I understand.
But my point is, look at the service. I would challenge anybody. Take a ride in a cab and then take a ride in the Uber. And for the price, rank how you were treated, how clean the car is. The Uber people have an incentive to give you good service because Uber, and here's this actually sort of is consistent with what Stoller is saying. Uber, like, will cut the drivers. Like, if you start giving drivers low scores, they will get rid of that driver. So they're very cutthroat about it. But part of that is to ensure customer satisfaction.
Right, and I think, you know, it has a lot of parallels to what's going on, you know, with bookstores or other retail shopping where Amazon, mainly Amazon, video and Netflix with video stores, you know, in my town, we've lost all our video stores. Bookstores are very squeezed. They're slowly dwindling. We've lost most of our record stores. So I find the transformation unsettling. There's things about it I certainly don't like, and I certainly try my best to shop locally when I can. But I, like others, are seduced by the convenience of internet shopping.
Right.
I have an Amazon.com credit card. As much as I hate Amazon, I get little bonuses when I
use it. This is part of the concern or cultural contradictions of capitalism. I mean, you know, the impulse for stability and to preserve institutions is a conservative impulse. And I would argue that there is, I don't care if Blockbuster closes. In fact, I think that streaming video is vastly superior for a variety of reasons. I do feel like there is some loss when bookstores close. And I know we have public libraries, but I feel like bookstores were serving as a sort of a third place. And I do feel like there is some additional, like, kind of societal loss associated with the closing of bookstores.
Well, I got to tell you, here locally in Northampton, you know, our video store was actually serving that social community purpose. Like, it actually was a place you would go and, like, hang out at the counter and, you know, see your neighbors, talk local issues, as well as talk movies. You know, it had this broader function. And, you know, I was not using Netflix at the time. I cut my cable. I wasn't using Netflix. I was getting my videos from the video store. There was, you know, I would pay a flat fee for a year, and I'd be able to rent, you know, cheaply that way. And I am mad that I no longer have that option. That option was taken from me by these market forces.
There's a great, I don't know if you've seen it.
I lost a degree of choice in competition because of what essentially is becoming an oligarchy. Yeah. But having said that, I don't think it would do liberalism much good to fight this tide, because obviously, people are voting with their feet on these types of things. People like the convenience. So if you're going to go to the mat on Uber and saying, no, you must take these cabs that you don't like.
But here's the problem, Bill.
I suspect it's going to be a losing
argument. Well, I guess two things. One, there's a good episode of Parks and Recreation where they try to keep a video store open. Have you seen this one? Anyway, check that out if you haven't seen it. But no, look, here's the fundamental point that I have failed to make, which is why this really matters. And it's that you want to have a society that encourages entrepreneurism and innovation. And not just for big companies, but for the kid who wants to start an app. Like, let's say that I had the idea of Uber first, and I was a techie, and I could go into my garage and create an app and then have, like, 10 of my friends to drive around D.C. and to get this thing off the ground. I would have probably been arrested. I would have probably been fined all sorts of money. I would have had to have spent probably, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of dollars to comply with the liability issues, legal issues, insurance. I mean, you name it. And so the problem is, what is the barrier of entry? And is our government laws and regulations essentially making it so that the next Uber or the next whatever can't happen, because we've created these disincentives for people who aren't big companies to take risks. And I think that's the real discussion to be had. That's what Marco Rubio was really getting at the other week when he spoke at the Uber office in Washington, D.C., is creating laws, laws and regulations that would have the effect of essentially strangling the baby in the crib. How do we avoid that situation? Because you and I think we would agree, we want outsiders and, children of prison guards and school teachers and, whatever, who are innovative and smart to be able to start a company and to not have to hire a bunch of lawyers and pay a lot of money to comply.
Well, this is where I sympathize a bit with Anthony Weiner, who had a column about this in his new, I think, Business Insider column, where he's talking about both Uber and I think it's also Tesla, because Tesla is having an issue in New Jersey. There are rules and regulations there about how car dealerships are structured. Tesla wants to have its own Tesla store, I guess, and the way New Jersey laws are structured, they can't do that as it stands. And Weiner's point was, look, maybe Tesla has an argument, maybe Uber has an argument, but these maybe rules or regulations have been set up for a long time with rationales, and it's a system that's been created that people have been abiding by and their livelihoods are dependent on now. So just waltz in and say, I want to do it this way, and if you don't do things my way right now, this proves that the whole system is terrible and markets are being squelched, yada, yada, yada. I mean, at minimum, it's worth taking a breath and saying, okay, maybe there is some reason why we have these rules, and we don't want to make it impossible for new ideas to emerge. Let's have a conversation about having a set of rules that will be fair to all, and not just tilt it from one end of the spectrum to sort of these three companies than just to serve your company. You know?
Well, I think one thing is we do need to acknowledge, conservatives need to acknowledge that creative destruction, while very good for the economy and very good for America in general, has martyrs and victims. And, there are people who, the horse and buggy trade that committed suicide, there are people who were, who there are losers when industries change and when technology changes. There are people who lose, and some of them cannot adapt and do not adapt, and there are real victims. And I also think that we, I don't know if you saw the Dallas Buyers Club movie, But it's a good movie. Obviously, it won a couple of awards for, I think, Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor. But, you know, essentially, you know, the Matthew McConaughey character gets AIDS, and, you know, the FDA is holding up all sorts of treatments that he believes, and, you know, would help him and others. And so he starts, you know, he can't sell them because that would be illegal. So he starts a club. And if you join the club, then part of the membership dues include you getting these supplements and herbs and medicine and whatnot that he smuggles into the country. And that is an example, I think, of where, you know, government regulations, you know, right now, apparently the best sunscreen, the best sunblock, is not FDA approved. We cannot buy it in America. Now, maybe there's something good about that, about our government being very careful and deliberative and cautious about which drugs and medicines they will allow to be put on the market. And maybe that'll save lives, or maybe it'll cost lives. And so I think that when we talk about the debate and the discussion about regulation, you know, yes, we need to have regulation, but sometimes well-meaning regulation has unintended consequences.
Sure. And, you know, this issue is happening right now with raw milk, where you can't sell raw milk across state lines. There's plenty of demand for raw milk. I like raw milk. I've driven to the farm to get raw milk. And there were buyers clubs that are being created to work around some of these regulations regarding sales. And they've been, I mean, clamped down a bit. But some people who are raw milk evangelists saying, you know, this is a perfectly wonderful, healthy product, and how dare the government, you know, get in the way of this? And this is an issue that you're going to get some overlap between left and right of this, because lots of liberals like farm fresh raw milk. But it's an issue where raw milk is safe when it's done, when it's micro produced. It would have a lot more health risk if it was macro produced. So you can't just lift all the regulations on, or else you're going to have public health problems. So there is some rationale to the law as it stands. Maybe you got to tweak it a bit to accommodate the demand, but you can't just say, just because one person says, I attest to this wonderfulness, get rid of these regulations, you have an FDA to say, actually, I'm going to not just take your word for it, I'm going to actually do some experiments and some research to make sure, so I don't cause like a mass.
And I know we're going in circles. We're going in circles here, but I mean, the obvious problem with that is that what happens is incumbent companies who are on top, who, you know, are doing well, lobby political officials to keep laws and regulations in place under the guise of protecting public safety, but in reality to preserve the financial interests of, I mean, you know, it goes back and forth. I will say I really love, you know, one of my favorite books is Rod Dreher's Crunchy Cons. And I do love these issues like raw milk and homeschooling and organic, you know, or breastfeeding, where cultural conservatives and tree-hugging hippie leftists can come together. I take solace in that. I like it. And I think Uber might be an example. And I think that's what Rubio's getting at a little bit, where it's a way that you can talk to kind of young techie millennials and teach them about free markets and the American dream.
Separate from that topic.
Yeah, there really are no segues, are there, to this?
I couldn't segue out of that. I'm just going to promote myself. Okay, that's my segue. Here's what I did this week. So I had a piece. People on the comments always love it when we talk about 2016. They say, why don't you talk about 2016 more? It's only 3 years away. Why don't you keep talking about it? So I had a piece because, you know, Jeb Bush made some noise over the weekend, saying that, you know, he's thinking about running. You know, would only do it sort of as on his terms. He wasn't going to, you know, sort of pander around everybody. He's going to do it joyfully, I think is his phrase. And then he made a comment about immigration, saying it's not a felony, it's an act of love. And that stirred up a lot of hackles. You know, Karl Rove was shaming him, saying he wasn't being politically astute. But it also came on the heels of a Larry Sabato column in Politico lamenting, you know, America's slide into monarchies, and that if, you know, if Clinton or Bush won and governed for 8 years, we'd have, you know, 28 years with, you know, the country run largely by two families, and the founding fathers would be aghast. They know a monarchical line when you see it, and I think other anti. I think you've been an anti-dynasty person when this subject has come up, but. I put a piece for the week saying let's just chill out on this. You know, America has no history of dynasties. You know, there are a couple isolated examples. There's the two Bushes and the two Adams. I think it's the Harrisons or a couple Harrisons. And you have a little bit with the Roosevelts, but Teddy and Franklin were not only very distant related. But Teddy's kids hated Franklin Roosevelt and thought he usurped the family legacy. So it wasn't like Teddy set him up to keep the lineage alive. And even just amongst you having politically connected aristocratic families, you go back the last 100 years, we've had 17 presidents. Only 4 of those, you could say, come from that sort of stock, the two Bushes, FDR, and Kennedy. His father was, you know, was ambassador, and FDR is chair of the SEC. Everybody else had not even necessarily all that wealthy, but you had no connection to national politics. You only had a couple, LBJ and Calvin Coolidge, who had ties to local politics. And you know, everyone else comes from, you know, grocery store owners and salesmen and farmers. You know, we're talking about this Clinton dynasty. Clinton is the stepson of a car dealer. So the fact that he is president and his wife is president, that's not a dynasty. That's a bit of a fluke. And it's not like the American voter has been mesmerized by familial candidates to the expense of others. Hillary Clinton lost to the son of an anthropologist in the Democratic primary in 2008. And no one thinks Jeb Bush's last name is somehow a free ticket to get the nomination, considering what his brother did as president. You'd say he'd have to overcome, not, I mean, he gets certain advantages. He gets a network, gets fundraising help, he gets the media attention. It's not like he gives him nothing, but it doesn't give him everything. You know, people, Americans, have a very long history of voting for the people they like and not voting for who gets shoved down their throat on the basis of their name. So, yes, there's a certain fluke of history here that you have a very active Bush family and an active Clinton family. These are two different families, for Pete's sake, who don't even agree on stuff. It's not like it's like people can't break into there are no barriers to entry here. You know, Barack Obama was able to overcome this. Clinton was able to overcome Bush in 1992, even though he was the son of a senator and Prescott Bush. So I just don't see where the panic is here. We have choices. You know, we have choices for our cabs and choices for our presidents. And that's not going to change if there's one race that's Clinton v. Bush.
You make a compelling case, but at the end of the day, we're left with a real possibility of a Bush-Clinton presidential race, which is
so you don't discount Jeb. You're not part of the Jeb camp. Jeb has no chance.
I think he has a chance. I think it's anybody's guess. I mean, I could go through the list and make a case for and or against anybody. So I don't write Jeb off at all. So I think there's a very real possibility that you could have a Bush-Clinton presidential race, which on the face of it's just insanity. In a nation of 300 plus million people, to have the wife of a former president, go up against the son and brother of a former president is evidence in and of itself of a dynastic tendency. Now, I'm not concerned. Don't get me wrong, Bill. I'm not worried that this is a sign that we are going to have a king or some sort of monarchy. I'm not, you know, that would be alarmist. But I do think that this says something about us, that the irony that we fought a war for independence against, you know, this monarchy. And, you know, and let's just be honest, Bill. Would you be that surprised if George P. Bush or Tag Romney were the nominee in 4 or 8 years to be to be president? I mean, it's not.
I mean, 8 years. I'm sure George P. Bush has his national ambition on his mind. You know, the Romneys are an example of, you know, sort of an anti-dynasty, a dynasty of losers. So I don't know, how that makes the dynasty case.
You know, being prominent. I mean, George Romney didn't get the nomination, but Mitt Romney did. But you get my idea. And the campaigns are covered by the son of Irving Kristol. You know, you go down the list. The son of Tim Russert. I mean, it's not just our candidates. It's not even just our politicians. It's the people covering them. It's by marriage in many cases. I think it does speak to the incestuous nature of our politics, and I think it says something about us at least.
Well, I think it's not any different than any other kind of business. Politics is a business. Media is a business. There are family businesses. There are family, there are family shoe businesses, and there's family cement mixing businesses, and there's family political businesses, and family, you know, media businesses. And I think if you get into the family business, to some extent, you got a leg up.
Well,
you know,
with George Romney, the good news is it's not determinative, as we saw with Liz Cheney, who tried to bigfoot a sitting U.S. senator, and it did not work. Of course, you will note she was back prominently on her perch on Fox News Sunday without missing a beat, but in any event,
right? She's gonna be okay.
Yeah, that kid's gonna make it.
Because she's in the family business, you know. She her parents know people. She knows who to ask for jobs. She knows who to network with. She has a financial cushion if something doesn't work out. You know, she certainly has advantages maybe some other people don't have, but. That's true in any business.
But is politics supposed to be a business, Bill? That's the inherent problem.
Well, it is. Well, let's be big boys and girls. It is. It's never going to be this. You go back to the Coolidges in Vermont, where everyone are sustenance farmers and a smattering of general store owners, and everybody takes turns in the legislature because they have 1 year terms. You know, that's not the system we have right now. We have there are career politicians, there are career public servants. If we didn't like it, we'd vote these people out or have 1 year term limits or everything again. We don't, because there's some value.
All I'm saying is there's something about this that rubs me the wrong way. I don't like it. And it's not, I'll go a step further. The Supreme Court of the United States, I think there are 9 members. I believe that all 9 of them went to either, one of 2 Ivy League schools. I think it's Harvard or Princeton, right? That is certainly an elite and certainly not representative. I don't think there's a single Protestant. I don't think there's a single evangelical on the court. I mean, they tried Harriet.
It's all Catholic.
They tried Harriet
Myers.
Yeah. So it's interesting how it works out. And look, the Ivy League thing is something that bothers me too. Ronald Reagan went to Eureka College. Harry Truman was just a high school graduate.
He's the last one.
But he was the last one until Scott Walker wins the presidency. Although he may have his degree by then. But I think that this speaks to, it's not just the sort of, dynastic tendency. It's also the insider elite thing. And if you look at, you know, the George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, you know, the one thing they have in common is their elite, you know, college pedigree. And that's
You know, Obama went Harvard Law. His, you know, he was at Pomona first, and then he transferred to Columbia. I mean, it's not, and Columbia's an Ivy, but it's not quite the same as being Harvard Yale.
What ain't Eureka? It's not Shepherd College, West Virginia.
It ain't Eureka. But Obama got there on his merits. He didn't get a free pass into Harvard Law.
I'm not suggesting he did. I'm saying that you know, all of these guys, whether they come from humble backgrounds or whether they come from you know, elite backgrounds, they're sort of all in the club.
There's going to be, you know, a degree of clubbiness in anything. I mean, that's you're never gonna stamp that out. Your networking exists. Yeah. You know, and chumminess and clickiness exist. But the question is, does it get so far that, you know, nobody from common stock has a shot? I mean, if it was like that, I would be more concerned. But Barack Obama is a classic example of how it's not like that. He worked his way into
And Marco Rubio,
it was not bestowed upon
Scott Walker and Marco Rubio. There are some Republicans on the that were being talked about that would also represent this American dream. I mean, Scott Walker didn't graduate from college. Marco Rubio went to, I think he went to like Florida State for his law degree, but he went to some random college. Is it like Tarkania? I forget the name of it. It may not even be there anymore. Like some college, like in the Midwest. You know, so there are some Republicans like Rubio and Walker and some others. I think Rand Paul went to Baylor or something. I mean, so there's going to be potential for some diversity in the White House coming up.
Now, I don't think you're a disingenuous sort, Matt, but I feel a lot of people taking the anti-dynasty line take it because they don't like Hillary and they don't like Jeb for policy reasons, for ideological reasons. And the dynasty things is an easy angle to try to get someone else to not like them who don't share your ideological view. I mean, how many Republican moderates are saying, "Jeb, I sure wish I could vote for Jeb. I'm so mad about dynasty. I'm going to vote for Rand Paul instead." I mean, there's nobody like that. And most Democrats are quite content with Hillary being the nominee. But the folks who think that she leans too right or is too close to Wall Street, whatever, I think they're more inclined to say, "Dynasty. We need Bernie Sanders or Brian Schweitzer." I mean, is that a fair nod?
Well, look, I think everybody, unfortunately, all the partisans, you know, create convenient arguments and cloak their partisanship and compelling arguments. But no, this is about me being like a contrarian and you know, there's the great scene from the movie Rushmore where Bill Murray's given the speech at Chapel. And he says, "Take dead aim on the rich boys. Get them in your crosshairs and take them out." And he says something like, "Just remember, they can always buy whatever they want, but they can't buy guts," or something like that. So, so I'm sort of in the, you know, partial to that. I mean, look, you know, all the people running are probably millionaires to some degree or another, but I think it might not be a bad idea every once in a while. Look, the last time we tried a guy from Eureka College, it worked out pretty well. And all of these best and brightest haven't always been the best and brightest. So I'm for the guy from Frostburg, you know, in Maryland and Eureka. So that's
I want to tell you one more piece before we wrap up, because you had a piece in the week too, and you generally have been very open to gays in the Republican Party and gays being conservatives. You have not tried to close the gates on diversity.
Well, part of this is that I have a huge gay fan base. That they love me, and I reciprocate. So,
well, but you're risking that bond with this other argument you've made in the week, saying that we shouldn't be firing people or discriminating against artisans or vendors who are anti-gay. So there was a court case in New Mexico where a wedding photographer was told she could not turn down a couple who wanted to use her for a gay wedding ceremony. And this is on the heels of what happened with Mozilla, where the CEO was forced to resign because of backlash from employees about him donating to Prop 8 in California. You are defending the freedoms of the anti-gay workforce, yet you are not saying that Republicans should keep gays out of their tent. So how do you square all that?
Right. So I think I'm basically in the Andrew Sullivan camp on all this. At this point I am. I mean, like, the whole thing with gay marriage, I've never lost a minute's sleep worrying about gay marriage, worrying about the gays taking over, or anything like that. I mean, I would have probably been years ago, you know, maybe civil unions would have been where I would have thought things should have gone, but I really don't, it doesn't confront me, it doesn't really bother me, but what does really concern me is I'm very concerned about defending free expression and religious liberty, and we have now entered into a point, I think, where it's a zero-sum game, where essentially there will be winners and losers, and, there's a tension between equality and liberty, and between whether or not there should be, equal protection under the law versus coercion and coercing people to violate their right of conscience. And this is a very serious debate, which I don't think is really being had. I think the media is almost universally on one side of this issue. But I think I'm on the Andrew Sullivan side. I'm, very, very concerned about defending people, their rights to have unpopular stands, even the right to be wrong. The obvious way to criticize me is to compare this, or people like me is to compare this to, segregation and lunch counters. I mean, I think that's a false analogy. To me, if you're a baker and you're baking a cake, that's one thing. I would probably, argue that the baker should be allowed, if the baker has a strong religious conviction that feels that baking this cake would violate their conscience, I would probably be much more comfortable saying, fine, I would bake the cake personally. I think Jesus would bake the cake. But if you feel strongly, I would not use the power of the state to coerce you. Now, when it comes to the photographer, now that's a whole different issue, right? A photographer has to physically go to a gay wedding, something that they may find violates their beliefs, and be a part of this ceremony, which they believe to be a sort of sacred religious ceremony. And then you could also argue that a photographer is an artist, and then that you're sort of, the state is now compelling someone who works in the creative field to decide what projects they will or won't take on. So I think it's a huge debate to have.
Well, I mean, I think the parallel to the Civil Rights Act is more apt in this wedding photographer situation. I mean, that says you can't deny services. We can't deny you a space at the lunch counter. We can't deny you a house. Can't deny you a service because of who you are.
Well, let me say that, though. Is a marriage ceremony who you are? So if I won't bake you a cake because you're gay, then that's a better analogy. I mean, some people would say that being gay isn't who you are, that it's an activity, but let's put that aside. Let's say that that's who you are, you were born that way. If I deny baking you a cake because you're gay, that's a better analogy. But if I deny baking you a cake for a marriage ceremony that I, for one reason or another, find to violate my conscience, that's not exactly analogous.
I mean, it strikes me as a bit of hair splitting, I gotta say.
But that's what the law is, Bill. I mean, the law is about drawing a line somewhere.
Right. I mean, I think we're a better society when we draw the line saying you don't deny services to people because of who they are, period.
I think this whole thing depends, Bill, depends on how you frame it. I mean, if you ask people, should you be allowed to deny service to somebody because of their sexual orientation, everybody will say, hell no, of course not. But if I ask you, Bill, should you be compelled to write a blog post for a white supremacist group that you disagree with because you're in the business of, let's say that you're a freelance writer or a ghostwriter, should you be allowed to deny, to turn them down? Everybody would say, of course you should. This is something that you, whether it's, you know, I'm not drawing a moral parallel between being gay and being a white supremacist, but if you happen to find this view to be antithetical to your beliefs, you should have the right to decline that. I think everybody would agree with that too.
I mean, obviously there's a difference between having to articulate a viewpoint with your name on it as providing a service for somebody else. I don't think that's a strong parallel. I think there's more of a case to make, I'm not saying I'm making it, but I think there's more of a case to make with the Mozilla situation because you're saying, or the argument can be framed as, if you hold a personal belief, you should not be able to hold this job. That's unrelated to your belief. That to me is a trickier situation than I think the providing service for somebody else situation.
Right. Well, I think that's indicative of where this fundamentally what bothers me about this is the notion that you cannot have a different opinion about this and be we're now at the point where if you disagree with gay marriage, not only are you not welcome in polite society, we may try to take your job away from you. That may happen. So you not only are you not welcome in polite society, you may be unemployable at this point. That stifles individuals.
That is true for racists now, isn't it? I mean, it would be hard to get hired in a lot of places if you were just walking around being
okay,
racist.
I will agree. Is opposing gay marriage tantamount to being a racist? I mean, I think you could be very pro-gay, and maybe you are for civil unions. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama a couple years ago were against gay marriage. I mean, I guess they were, like, 2 years ago, Barack Obama wasn't, qualified to run a crappy internet browser. I mean... isn't it possible that you can have a different point of view based on whether it is a devout, principled, biblical understanding of something or a misguided, bigoted viewpoint and still, not be completely written out of polite society?
I think it is possible. I think the Obama analogy is always, I think it generally doesn't work. I mean, I see Republicans make it all the time, and I see it never get them anywhere because I think everyone knows the broader context there, which is he was actively supporting advancements in gay rights at the time. He was stopping short at marriage for a period of time.
Okay, fair enough,
life,
but I can show you a video of Hillary Clinton saying, I believe that marriage is an institution between one man and one woman.
Yes, she did say that. And it's possible she didn't even believe it when she said it.
So that's a better, so the fact that she was pandering and that she's a political opportunist is somehow better than if she had actually had a principled position on that?
But what I'm saying is that she wasn't at the time, in the political context of the time, promoting bigotry and treating gays as lesser. She was trying, even at that moment... she was still arguing for other forms of advancements in gay equality.
Okay.
We're still talking about 20 years ago here. Obviously, as you like to point out to me, Robert Byrd was with the KKK at one point, but he evolved over time, and so we didn't drum him out into the Senate in his later years because he had shown advancement in his views. Both Hillary and Obama have advanced in their views, whether it's on the level or disingenuously or what have you. There still was never a sense from either of them that they were trying to...
The problem with this bill, it is character
lesson.
Assassination. Let me just... I'll give you an example. I am devoutly pro-life. I believe that that if someone else... I believe that abortion is tantamount to murder, okay? It's a big deal to me. But if you are pro-choice, I assume you are, I mean, I am not going to think that you are a murderer. I mean, I may think that you're misguided or that you're wrong. We could still hang out. We could still be friends. We could still have a beer. Maybe you just believe right. that, maybe you just happen to believe that, that life begins at a different time than I do, right? But we can be civil about that. But that is not what's happening in this debate.
Yeah.
We're having character assassination where if you disagree with the pro-gay agenda, you are now an evil, bad person who must be basically run out of polite society and maybe rendered unemployable. That is horrible for democracy. That is horrible for free expression. And it's frankly an illiberal notion. And that's why I'm with Andrew Sullivan.
Well, I mean, I think that if for those who have a religious view that you're just not going to be persuaded by legalistic arguments, it's just your interpretation of the Bible and that's that. But otherwise, you don't consider yourself to be bigoted or think, I mean, obviously, the whole premise of Christianity is that we're all sinners, and we don't treat other sinners as if they don't deserve legal protections, right? If those folks were doing other things to show that gay people in society should not be discriminated against, I think that argument would go down easier. I mean, if you say, I'm against gay marriage, but I'm for Edna, that would probably, that doesn't have to be that, but that would be an example of saying, look, I'm not saying gays should be treated under the law as second-class citizens. And you know, perhaps, I don't know everything about the Mozilla case. I don't think it should be the law that people who are anti-gay should not be able
well,
to
thank
get
God
work
for that.
And feed themselves.
Glad it's not going to be actually, you know, a statute, but it just happens to be in de facto, you know, what's happening.
But I also understand that he's CEO of a company with gay employees, and if I was the employee of a company where my boss was clearly bigoted against people like me, I'd probably say
sure.
something
but
about it.
But don't you think, Bill, isn't it possible to be pro-gay, not bigoted, and maybe even in favor of civil unions or something else, but also believe that the word marriage has for thousands of years meant something that's worth preserving? It's an institution between one man and one woman, and it's a sacred, you know, covenant that should be, maybe it's a matter of semantics, but that should be preserved in something special. You can have something different. Look, of course you should be able to visit your partner in the hospital, in the emergency room. Of course you should be able to form a contract with somebody else and have inheritance or what, you know, whatever. But if someone holds that view today, they are considered, they're essentially drummed out of polite society. And I think that's, like, number one, it's simplistic. It's not nuanced at all. It's just horrific.
Look, I think that, well, one, I don't think the marriage is a strictly sacred argument. I don't think it holds water. But look, people can have opinions I don't agree with and still be good members of society. You know, so again, I don't think that the standard should be you have to agree with my opinion and everything, otherwise you can't work. That's not a reasonable stance.
Well, when you go around as a prominent columnist did a few months ago or a few weeks ago, when you say people who disagree with you are tantamount to segregationists and that it's comparable to Jim Crow, that's you are effectively ending the debate, ending the conversation, and casting anyone who disagrees with you as you know, it's demonizing, to be clear. I mean, it's like being accused of rape. Being accused of being a racist is character assassination. If it's not true, it's especially bad. It's just it's something that you cannot be and be taken seriously. And I think that's a good thing. But I don't think this is analogous to that. By the way, I think this is one of the this is proof of how bad the sin of slavery and later of segregation is, that it is still impacting these debates as we go forward. And I think that it is an example of how those horrific sins and wrongs still continue to hurt I would say conservatism today, because they're being used, I think I would argue inappropriately, to against religious liberty and free expression in this case.
I want to give you the last word because you've been gone for so long and the DMZ misses you. And we've also run long.
Glad we got back with an easy topic, Bill. Glad we didn't enter into anything controversial or.
but yet I think the DMC DMC rules are still in effect.
I hope so. I mean, I know you and I are going to be cool. But
I might have to fire you from this show now. But beyond that, I think we're fine.
I know we are. I just wonder if I don't know if the viewers, like, if a show like this leaves them feeling warm and fuzzy. Or if they think we're fighting. I don't think we're fighting. I think we're just starting to talk, you know? I mean, it's like Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jerry Maguire. I don't think we're fighting, but they may, so we're not.
We're not. Fighting, not fighting.
DMZ style, right? So you can follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show, on Facebook /DMZ Show. I think that's right.
I think that's right.
All right.
Good to have you back.
Got it.
We'll talk next week.
See ya.